Hello, everyone, and welcome to this Cops Alive audio program. My name is John Marks. I'm the editor of copsalive.com. I thank you for listening. I want to let you know that Cops Alive was founded to help police officers and other law enforcement professionals plan for happy, healthy, and successful lives on the job and beyond. And we do that by assembling as much useful information as we can for you. And we put that on the blog site at Cops Alive. We also do training programs, and we have this new live webinar that we're doing. So I hope this is useful to you. Today's subject is a very serious one. Our guest is Kelly Young, who is the widow of slain Denver Police Detective Donald, or Donnie, Young, whose unfortunate end of watch was May 8, 2005. Detective Young was killed in the early morning hours of Mother's Day, 2005, while he was working off-duty in uniform at a private baptismal celebration. Young and his partner had asked some young men who were trying to crash the invitation-only party to leave, and they became kind of combative, so they were escorted out of the building by Detective Young. And a short time later, one of the men came back to the party with a gun and shot down both officers. Detective Young was killed, and his partner was wounded but saved by his bulletproof vest. Pretty serious subject. Kelly, I thank you very much for being our guest. Are you out there?
I am. Thanks for having me, John. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you're very welcome. I think maybe we should start this from the beginning, maybe, and have you share a little bit about your life, your marriage to Donnie, and maybe some things that led up to this very unfortunate Mother's Day in 2005.
Absolutely. I first of all would like to thank you. I appreciate you, you know, bringing light to this subject and getting people more aware, you know, and letting me express what widows go through and what families go through. It's all about bringing awareness and making it better for the next person.
Thank you.
Basically,
we appreciate you doing that.
Donnie and I are both, you know, pretty much originally from Colorado Springs, and we had met about 2 years prior to getting married. We got married in 1988, and Donnie was just, I was fairly shy and reserved when we first met, and that was one of the things that attracted me to Donnie, is he just really felt he needed to live life to its fullest and, you know, was just wanting to experience all different types of things, was very fun and happy-go-lucky type of a person, which was completely opposite of what I was like. So I think the whole opposites attract is definitely, there's something to be said for that. But shortly after we got married, Donnie started his police career with El Paso County, the Sheriff's Department. And he worked in the jail. Unfortunately, he didn't. The jail was a good stepping stone for him, but it wasn't anything that he could see as a lifelong career. He just didn't get that fulfillment out of working in the jail. But we, you know, he went through his time and got to know the system a little bit. And in the meantime, you know, we really just enjoyed being with each other. We did a lot of camping, a lot of boating. We had a group of friends that we went to the lake with every weekend. We enjoyed vacationing in Mexico. So just, you know, young couple just kind of experiencing life together. He got on with Denver in 1993, and that was one of the best things, I think, that ever happened to Donnie, besides getting married to me, of course.
Of course.
And he just really enjoyed his job. You know, I know sometimes some of the police officers just kind of get stagnant and it's just a job with good benefits, but Donnie really enjoyed his job, and he, you know, he especially enjoyed it when he got into the vice and narcotics area. I think one of the nicest things he enjoyed about it was because he could dress down. You know, he could wear his jeans and his T-shirts and, you know, could let his hair grow long and had an earring and all that good stuff. And but it was a job that he just really, really enjoyed doing. I remember when we first moved into our Castle Rock neighborhood, all my neighbors kind of wondered actually what he did for a living, because, you know, he would always be dressed kind of scummy and hair was long, and he'd kind of come and go at all hours of the night. And, you know, finally one of my neighbors said, "What exactly is it that your husband does for a living?"
He's a pretend drug dealer.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Well, there is kind of a funny story. My oldest, Courtney, when she was little, somebody asked her one time what your dad did for a living, and she actually came out with, "Well, he sells drugs."
Oh, great.
I know. So that wasn't good. That wasn't good. But he, you know, he enjoyed doing what he was doing. And I can remember one time he came. We always had an extra car seat after Kelsey was born, and I can remember him coming home and the car seat was missing. And I asked him, you know, he had his undercover car, and of course he was working the vice unit, and I said, "Where's Kelsey's car seat?" And he said, "Well, I pulled over to help a gal who had a flat tire, and when he pulled her over, she had a 3-4-year-old sitting in the back seat that of course was not in a car seat. So Donnie felt compelled to give her the car seat." And so it just kind of, you know, shows you what type of person he was. Just very caring, and it didn't matter if it was family or strangers. You know, he was always willing to you know, lend a helping hand to help someone else. But we did, as soon as they lifted the ban that you had to live inside the Denver city limits, we did move out to the Castle Rock area. And we would have stayed in the Denver area, but, you know, the house was just too small, and the prices in the Denver area where we were, the particular area where we were living in, had just skyrocketed, and I was about done with the remodeling thing and told him, "No, we're buying a new house and no more remodeling." Needless to say, we went from remodeling the inside to having to do the lawn, so I don't know which was better.
Yeah, maybe not a good trade-off.
I know. But at the time, I was actually still working down in Colorado Springs, so the Castle Rock area was perfect for us. We kind of both did a 50-50 on that commute, and it worked out well. We liked the Castle Rock area. But then actually just prior to Donnie's death, we had sold the first house that we had purchased out in Castle Rock and put in a contract to buy a ranch. And Donnie had always wanted a ranch house. He didn't really like having to go up and down the stairs. And our plan was we were going to downsize a little bit, and then in the near future I would be able to stop working and spend more time, you know, with the girls, our two girls. Mm-hmm. And the ranch style house that we picked was just down the street from where our old house was. And we had moved in. We'd had some contract issues on selling on purchasing our new home, and there was a problem with the title. And so we had moved in, and we had been there about a month, but hadn't actually purchased the home. And that's when, you know, our world kind of fell apart. That Saturday, you know, was our usual day. Both our girls were in soccer, and I took Kelsey and went one direction, and he took Courtney and a lot of the girls from the soccer team, and they went to a soccer game. And it was kind of a strange day because the girls didn't play very well, and being the fact that they were all 13, you know, they had some attitude. One of the refs wasn't, you know, according to them, wasn't, you know, calling the game good. And some of the girls just had a really bad attitude during the game. And Donnie was just really disappointed in them. He had gotten quite a close connection with a lot of these girls, and a lot of the girls came to him when they didn't feel that they could talk to their parents. You know, Donnie was just very easy to talk to, and he was a straight shooter. You know, if he felt you were doing something wrong, he'd call you on it, and if he felt you were doing a great job, he'd let you know. And on the ride home, it's just kind of ironic. He had expressed to these girls, you know, his disappointment in the way that they had acted during the game and the lack of respect and things like that. And it was a conversation that went from, you know, you girls need to learn how to give it your all, and, you know, you never quit. You always, you know, keep and try your hardest to really what life's all about. And they had gotten into this discussion about the meaning of life and what, you know, what you're here on earth for, and you make the best of it. You live life to its fullest. You know, he had just really, during this 45-minute drive, had quite the life lesson talk with these group of 8-9 girls. And then we had, you know, met just briefly. He handed Courtney over to me, got ready, and went to work that night at the Solano Campo. And he called, which he always did, and, you know, said the night was, you know, pretty uneventful, doesn't, you know, crowd's pretty good, I should be home on time. And, you know, and he had also talked, you know, that's how I knew about the whole conversation on the way home from the soccer game, is because he, you know, had talked to me about it and told me what had happened. And, but, you know, he, you know, it was nothing out of the ordinary. You know, it was a late night for him, so we had all gone to bed, and, you know, then the whole world unravels. You know, the doorbell rang, and I, of course, thought he had forgotten his keys, and, you know, went to the door to open the door, and you open the door, and you immediately see the chief of police standing there, and it was Chief Whitman, as well as one of Donnie's best friends, Jimmy Ettinger, and you just immediately know. I mean, you know, Donnie had had accidents before at work. You know, a few years before, he had been in a car accident, and I had gotten a, you know, midnight phone call that he was in the hospital because of a car accident. And so it wasn't, you know, I was used to, you know, getting those phone calls in the middle of the night that, you know, something's happened, he's going to be home late. You know, it's just, it's part of being married to a police officer.
Yeah.
And, you know, but yet when you open that door and you see the chief of police standing there, you know, it's different, and you know it's different. And, you know, they came in, and I can, you know, I can just remember the two of them going, you know, who should we call? Who should we call to come and be with you? And, you know, they had kind of explained what had happened, but they didn't, you know, they didn't want to go into too much detail. I think they just wanted my mind to hear, he's gone, now what do we do? And, you know, I, of course, gave him, you know, my sister's phone number, who, you know, lived down in Colorado Springs. All of our family, mine including Donnie's, lived down in Colorado Springs. And so you're frantically trying to even remember phone numbers because you're in such a daze that you're just not within your own right mind. And my sister got up here as quick as she could, and then, you know, then of course I have to do the unthinkable, and that's go in and talk to my daughters.
Yeah.
And, you know, Kelsey was only 5, and I went in there and I woke her up, and, you know, I mean, what do you even say? You don't even know what to say. And, you know, I just told her, you know, that there was an accident, and, you know, we went through the whole, you know, daddy's in heaven, and, you know, and she just laid back down and went back to sleep. And I thought, okay. and then I had to go in and tell Courtney, and she was 13. And the conversation just, I mean, she was hysterical, as you would expect. You know, but it's very difficult as a mom or as a dad to, you know that your life now has changed forever. It's falling apart. But yet part of you knows how strong you have to be to sit here and talk to your children. And, you know, I look back and I remember kind of thinking and knowing to myself that this conversation that I have and how I act within these next few days are either going to make or break us. And because your children are looking to you for guidance, they're looking at you to tell them everything's going to be okay, that, you know, we can make this, we can do this. And it's just, you know, it's something that you don't think that you can ever do, nor would you ever want to do. But when you're faced with it, some inner strength or something comes over you that lets you get through it. It's, then I think the next hardest part was, I remember Chief Whitman saying, do you want to go to the hospital? And, you know, we knew Donnie was already gone. But I'm glad that they let that be my choice. A lot of police, a lot of departments don't leave that choice up to the family members to give them the right to go and see their loved one. And I did choose to go and see Donnie. I can remember the ride from my house down to the hospital, and you know, it just seemed like the longest drive in my life. I can't even remember how we got there. I remember them saying that we had to go through the back doors because of the media. And, you walk in and there's a room full of probably 20, 30 people, and I knew no one. They're all strangers. And here they're seeing you at your most vulnerable time, and there's nobody familiar in the crowd. It's very scary. I chose to go in and be with Donnie. I did not choose to see him. He had the blanket over him, and for me that was just a personal choice. I wanted to remember Donnie the way I remembered him. I did not want to remember him lifeless.
Yeah.
But I know for a lot of people, including some of Donnie's friends, they had to go down there and look at him and actually see him in order to know that he was gone. And I know for a lot of other spouses, it doesn't register that person is actually gone until they can actually see it for themselves. So I'm glad that Denver did give me that option. If I would have wanted, to take that. The days after that were just completely crazy. I mean, I had people in my house that I didn't even know who they were. I mean, it was just when they come to you, and I think this applies to any time you lose someone, regardless if they're a police officer or not. People ask you, who do you need us to notify? Who do you want us to call? And, of course, I went down through the whole list of relatives and friends and family and, everybody that I thought would want to hear rather than hear it on the news. Mm-hmm. But what I didn't know was all those people would be at my house. And it's just, mm-hmm. There were days when I just wanted to scream and just say, get out. Just go away. because you get to where you feel a stranger in your own environment. I mean, I had to go outside. I would go for a walk just to get away from, all of the people that were in my house. You have to somehow find a happy medium between getting people there that can support you and getting rid of those people who aren't supportive that just are just there. Yeah. If that makes sense.
Well, I would imagine that this is one case where it's very different in a police setting, because in a family death, you have family and friends, but in a police setting, you have this gigantic, quote-unquote, extended family of people that are trying to help you and trying to make arrangements for you and are thinking about the enormity of a police funeral and everything that goes with it.
Right, right. And then you put the media into that.
Yeah.
Which adds a whole nother dynamic to it. Luckily for me, I lived on a cul-de-sac, and the Douglas County Sheriff's Department actually they put a car at the end of my street so that, nobody could come up. But it's things like that that you're thrown into overnight that you have no idea how to deal with it, how to react, it's something that you're not used to. It adds a whole nother level of stress on it.
I can't even imagine.
As far as the funeral arrangements and things like that, when I compare the funeral arrangements that I had to make versus someone who loses someone that's not on the police department, you know, mine was a lot easier, if I can, you know, if you can even throw out that word, because all I, you know, we met with a group of people and, you know, I had to say, I want this casket, not that casket. I'll pick that church. I want this person to speak. And really, they did a wonderful job taking it and doing it, doing everything for me. You know, I did not have to come up with, you know, $10,000 before the funeral home would even speak with me. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's something that people need to talk to their loved ones about and say, what, you know, what do you want? Because I didn't really know what Donnie wanted. I went with what I thought he would want. But, you know, if you don't, I know sometimes people have a fear of talking about things, but if you, you know, everybody's going to die at some point. So you might as well talk about it and know what the other person's wishes are rather than leave that to your loved ones to try to have to figure out for you. You know, just talk about what each other's wishes are. It doesn't mean you're casting a shadow on them. It makes those decisions much easier for the loved ones that are left behind.
Well, and I suspect that's one of those conversations that you should have sooner than later. I know my father was in his 80s when he died, and my mom said the same thing. I didn't know what he wanted. And
yeah.
So I think that is the kind of conversation that most people will put off forever. And maybe one thing that can come out of today for those people that are listening is that maybe they'll have that conversation when they're young and spry, and it can be a comprehensive conversation.
Right, right. Yeah, it's, you know, just something as simple. It's kind of funny, the things that you remember and the things that you don't, you know, that you don't remember. But, you know, I can remember, you know, within those first couple days taking Courtney shopping because, I mean, she was 13. All she had were, you know, was jeans, shorts, and T-shirts, and she didn't have anything to wear to funeral. And, you know, my sister and I took her shopping, and I can remember being in Express and, you know, having her try on these different clothes, and the sales lady said, you know, oh, do you, you know, have a special event to go to? And I just completely lost it, and I'm like, oh, my God, you have no idea, you know. But it's kind of those little things that you never, you know, and that's one thing that I remember. I remember being in the dressing room. I remember bringing her, you know, black pants and going and buying her shoes. And, I mean, it's just, it is strange, the things that your mind allows you to remember. And then some of it you just kind of block out. I mean, I actually had to borrow a suit from my sister because I didn't have anything that I thought would have been appropriate, you know, to wear to a funeral. And I can remember, you know, getting up that morning, the morning of the funeral, and thinking that if I didn't, you know, if I just didn't go, you know, I can completely remember standing in my bathroom and talking to my sister and saying, you know what, I don't want to go. And, you know, her saying, well, you have to go. And, you know, in my own mind, I'm thinking, if I don't go, it's not going to happen. Therefore, it didn't happen, and my life will resume as it was.
Wow.
And, you know, I can remember my sister telling me, you know, that it's going to be a beautiful ceremony. It's going to be something that we're always going to remember and cherish, and it's only 24 hours. And she said, if you can make it through this day, you can make it through any day. And, you know, tomorrow it'll be a little bit easier. And I reach back onto that quite a lot, and I do use that a lot when I'm talking to other widows to say, you know what, especially when the anniversary comes up, I say today is only 24 hours. You can make it through today, and tomorrow it will be a little bit better. And she was right. You know, we went, obviously, and, you know, we made it through the day, and it's almost a day that, you know, there are very few parts of it that I remember. And thank God that the police department did take a lot of pictures, because, you know, after it was over, I actually did have to look back through the pictures to remember certain parts of it, because people would be talking and they'd say, you know, Ral, do you remember this? And I would be, no, I don't remember that. And I can remember the media calling me when Detective Jensen was killed down in Colorado Springs, and the lady said, what would be the one thing that you would say to his widow? And I think her funeral was the next day, and I said, I would tell her to try and take it all in, because it's beautiful and she'll want to remember it. Because I can remember Jeff Barron, you know, speaking, and the fact that he made reference to Courtney and the fact that Donna used to buy her Lucky Jeans, which, you know, we used to argue about all the time because they were way too expensive for a 13-year-old. And I can remember the ride from the church to Fort Logan, and I can remember the fire department ladders that went up above the street and the fact that they had the American flag hanging there. I can remember all the school kids. We passed a school, and they were all standing on the inside of the chain link fence with their hand over their heart. And I remember thinking, oh, my God, this has not only affected my family or the police department. This has affected the whole community. And, you know, to know that someone's death had such an incredible effect on people is it's very heartwarming. You know, it's a very comforting feeling. If that makes sense.
I've attended so many police funerals, and I was at Donnie's, and it was one of the largest and one of the most moving I remember. But I do agree that, as even from my perspective as a police officer, one of the positives that come out of a day like that are those signs that show you that the community really cares, and even though they didn't know this person, even though they didn't know Donnie, you know, they respected him, they respected you, they respected the authority of the police, and they were there to honor all of that and all of you. And those things are very heartwarming. And, you know, I think any police officer that hasn't seen that needs to see those kind of things, because sometimes we forget that the public really cares, because we don't see the part of the public that cares, and they don't ever tell us. And so I agree with you that those little symbols are really very powerful.
Yeah, and that was kind of after that funeral was, you know, one of the reasons why I decided to talk to the media as much as I did. Because I just, you know, every time you turn the news on, it's negative, negative, negative towards the police department. And I really somehow wanted to make an impact on that. And I knew what type of police officer Donnie was. And I just really felt that it was part of my responsibility to the police department, as well as Donnie's legacy, to show everyone that, you know, they are real people. They do have real lives. They do have families. And for the most part, they are out there to keep order between right and wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think it helped. I mean, I had a fairly decent rapport with the media for the most part. And I think as the trial got closer, I think they kept my family in mind and were a little bit more compassionate than they may have been had they not got to know me and my family. But it, you know, it's, again, that's a decision that each family, you know, has to make on their own. You know, I chose to be out in the limelight and speak about my situation. But there's a lot that don't want to do that. And, you know, there is no right way or wrong way. It all just depends on how you feel and what your circumstances are.
Yeah. Well, we all heal from things like this differently, and some people need to share and some people don't want to.
Right. Right. But then, you know, really after the funeral was over is really when all the, you know, we met with the district attorney regarding what, you know, what they thought was happening regarding where, you know, Raul Gomez-Garcia was and what our chances were and what our options were. And I'm really, you know, thankful. I mean, I'm sure the district attorney had their idea of what they wanted to do and what they would want to persuade me to do, but it didn't feel that way. When they met with me, Mitch Morrissey actually, you know, put all the options out there on the table and said, what would you like to do? You know, and he said, I'm not saying that's what we're going to do, but what would you like to see happen? And it kind of gave me a little bit of ownership of it. You know, I was able to voice my opinion and, you know, and to be honest with you, this, the whole immigration thing and the illegal immigrants, and that was something that, you know, I really wasn't all that familiar with. I mean, I knew that we had, you know, Spanish-speaking people over to do yard work. I knew Donnie was friends with people that probably weren't here legally. You know, I mean, I didn't know. You didn't ask.
Yeah.
You know, our friends and our acquaintances were based off what type of person they were. They weren't necessarily based off whether they had a green card or not. So it was really, it was on a whole new territory for me. And, you know, then you had people calling you, wanting you to take a stand one way or another. And that was very difficult for me.
For a second, for those people listening that don't know the story, the suspect in this case was a Mexican national citizen who fled from the United States to Mexico. And first there was the challenge of identifying who the suspect was, but then once they did, there was a bigger problem in dealing with extradition because the death of a law enforcement officer can involve the death penalty, and there was a lot of bickering back and forth between the United States and Mexico about whether they would extradite someone who would be subject to the death penalty, and I would imagine you were thrust right in the middle of that.
Yeah, we were. We were, and it was very difficult because it was something, like I said, that I wasn't very familiar with, and I really didn't know how I felt about it. You know, if you would have asked me prior to Donnie's death how I felt about the death penalty, I would be the first one to say, you know what, you take someone else's life, you deserve to lose your own. Mm-hmm. And I felt strongly about that. I felt strongly about the overcrowding of the prisons, that the taxpayers were paying for it, that they were living better than some of our homeless people. You know, it was something that I felt strongly about. But when it's in your own backyard, you have to back up and look at it again. You know, would I have liked him to have been eligible to spend the rest of his life in prison? Yes. Did I want to make the decision of whether or not he was to be put to death? I really didn't want that. I really didn't want to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to the district attorney about that, and I said, you know, at this point, what my main objective was to get him caught, because in my mind, if you will blatantly kill a police officer, you'll kill anybody. And you know, my fear was, at that time we had no idea what his background was. We didn't know if he was involved with gangs. We didn't know anything. And you know, my fear was that he would be willing to kill anybody, and I certainly did not want anybody else to be killed by the hands of this kid.
Mm-hmm.
And the district attorney did agree, and I think they felt the same way, was we just need to get him back. Even if we can't go after life, we can't go after the death penalty, let's just get him back here. And you know, it's, gosh, it's, you know, it's really something that as normal citizens, you really don't even want to have to think about ever in your life. Because it does, it throws you into a complete different arena that you're not used to, unless you're already into the political area, which I wasn't at all. But they, when they did catch him, it was kind of a little eerie. Also, I'd spent that Christmas in California, and we just kind of wanted to get away from here. And we went to California for Christmas. And when I was in California, I got the call from the police department to say, we've got him and he's on his way back. And the eerie part of it is I was staying in L.A. and he had flown in to L.A. And I was probably only about 20 miles from the airport, which was just, that just hit me different that we were both in the same place at the same time. And it was just very eerie to me. But they got him, they got him back here, and I was extremely happy about that.
So it was from May until December before they were able to identify him and have him extradited back?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was fairly quick. I mean, it was fairly quick.
And I was thinking that was a long time. And I'm kind of wondering what your life was like. It must sort of be like limbo, waiting and wondering and having months go by. And I think it took a while to identify him, and then a little while longer to find him, didn't it?
Well, and the hard part about the being in limbo part is just that I think because he was a Denver officer, the Denver news was just, it was on the news all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And you almost couldn't get away from it. Every time you turned on the TV, there was Donnie's picture on there. And, you really didn't get used to seeing it. Every time I turned on the TV and I saw it, it would take me back again.
Yeah.
And it just, I think the news coverage is great, but it's, it makes it difficult for the families to kind of put it on the back burner. But he was actually arrested on June 4th of 05, and then he was extradited on December 23rd of 05.
So most of the time was just in legal wrangling to try to get him back to the United States.
Right. He had been picked up, and it goes from getting calls, you're getting calls once, a couple times a day to say, okay, this is what we have here, this is what we've got there, he's here, the U.S. Marshals have picked him up, and I'm very lucky in that sense that the legal process was quick, to go from being extradited the end of December to, the trial in early September of 06, whereas a lot of families have to wait years. And it makes it very difficult to move forward with your life when you're constantly knowing that you've got this huge life event coming up.
Yeah.
But the trial, just again, an area that, I had been in the courthouse. Well, I had never been in the Denver courthouse. When I lived down in Colorado Springs, I had done jury duty once, and that's my extent of the court system. It's very scary. I can remember, the first day going down there, I didn't even know where the courthouse was. I didn't know how to get there. And I think this is where the police departments need to step up a little bit. I mean, they assume because this is an area that they deal with every day that, the spouses just know the process. And, I didn't. I would have loved for you know, an officer to have been assigned to me to take me to the courthouse every day. Because even just walking in, you know, I was allowed to park in the police parking at police headquarters, but just walking from my car into the courthouse was a zoo. I mean, you've got cameras all over the place. People are taking your pictures. They're asking you questions. I mean, it was just, you don't know whether you're coming or going. I mean, I don't know, just from going from a fairly introvert personality, having my own little life out here in Castle Rock, to all of a sudden being thrust into this, it was very scary. You know, plus you're dealing with your own emotions.
Yeah, well, so, even as we're talking, I can imagine that lots of little things will remind you of stuff that you had forgotten years afterwards.
Right.
And that's got to be hard. And I can imagine the trial would bring it all rushing back.
It does. And it's very, you know, I can remember the first time that I saw Raul Gomez Garcia. I just, you know, before I saw him, I tried to really give him the benefit of the doubt that, you know, he just something went wrong that night. You know, that it was a spur-of-the-moment thing, or it was, I mean, I don't know. But I was really trying to say, to make terms with it in my own mind. And, you know, then when I saw him, and he just, I mean, he was a kid, but he just, the way he looked at me, and he gave me this little smirk, and I just, all bets were off. I mean, I just wanted to wring his neck.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of you want to go through those things with dignity and just get through it and be the bigger person. But, I mean, there were just nights when we would come home from the trial and I would just cry for hours and hours and hours because you just – you stay strong all day long, and then you lose it. And having to be strong like that in front of the police department, in front of the media, in front of the community, in front of your own family and your children, it's difficult. It's very difficult. And the trial is kind of one of those bittersweet things. You very much want it to be over and done with, but then in the back of your mind, you know as soon as the trial's done, then all of the attention is going to go away. And even though it's not always attention that you want, it's still attention, and it's still reminding you that your husband's life was worthy, that people miss him, that they know that you miss him. And as soon as the trial's over, everything starts to go away. And it's you kind of go through that loss all over again.
Well, it's probably like losing your extended family.
Exactly.
I would imagine in the life of a survivor, there are many lonely times, and I would think that would be one of the, probably the first night and then right after the trial would be a screamingly loud silence.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I just really, I mean, I've had a couple other widows here in Colorado who have had to go through trials, and as much as you don't want to say that to people, I've actually, you know, came out and said, you know, be prepared for this because this will happen. And you think in your own mind, no, that's not going to happen. You know, my department's different than that. You know, my husband had closer friends. You know, my husband's death was more traumatic. You know, whatever you put in your mind to say that this isn't going to happen to you, the reality is it does happen. And, you know, my way of thinking is if I can at least plant a little seed with them to let them know that, number one, it's okay, it's normal, and kind of somehow get them prepared, because it doesn't just gradually go away. It drops. you know, you go from that first anniversary getting, you know, 100 cards in the mail to when the second year anniversary comes along, you maybe get one or two. I mean, it's kind of unbelievable almost. And it's I guess it's just human nature that people think, okay, the bulk of it's over and I need to get back to my life and they need to move on and get on with their life. But regardless of why it happens, it's still very, very painful.
Well, you and I have met, and I've shared this with you. You know, I'm one of those people that doesn't know what to do and doesn't know what to say, and you don't want to intrude on somebody's life who's already suffered so much trauma, and it's a very strange balancing act. And I that's one of the reasons I'm so glad that you came and shared your story, and I've heard you share your story many other times. And I think people need to hear it. I think they just need to know that it's okay, and I think people need to hear from your lips what you felt, and so that everyone that comes after you may have a better chance and may have a better experience, I mean, if there can be such a thing, so that we can all learn. You know, we all say we're one big family. Don't worry, Kelly. You just say what you need, and we'll be there for you, but I can imagine that that goes away pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I think that's the hardest part. I think if it wasn't said, then it wouldn't be expected.
Right.
You know, but it's just, you know, everything surrounding the police department is such a brotherhood. You know, we're a police family. You know, we're going to take care of our own. We'll be there no matter what you need. And then when you do need them, most will not ever ask for help, even if they need it.
Right.
Two, if they do ask for help and they don't get any response back, they will never ask for help again. They will just go away. And, you know, and I can just say from my personal experience, I mean, I've reached out to the police department very few times, but the few times that I have, I haven't gotten what I needed. And, you know, it puts a little bit of bitterness there, and, you know, I won't ask the question again.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, I can throw out one example of, you know, I had a shadow box, and you know, when an officer dies in the line of duty, there's an awful lot of medals that come your way. And Donnie had received a lot of accommodations throughout his career. And I wanted to put those in a safe place, and I got a shadow box. But I had no idea how those medals were to be put in there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can remember, well, I most of the time, the only time I hear is if they need something from me. And I had gotten a call from, you know, one of the higher-ups, and he had a question for me, and I answered it. And then he said, well, you know, how are you? Is there anything that you need? And I thought, okay, just do it, Kelly, just do it. And I said, you know, as a matter of fact, I do. I need help doing the shadow box. I don't know how the medals go. You know, is there somebody on the department that could do this for me or walk me through it? And he said, well, you know, I really don't know. This one goes there, and that one goes there, and that about does it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, thanks for your help. And I ended up, I go out about once every couple months with the wives of the bomb squad unit, which is where Donnie was within his career when he died. And I had mentioned that to one of the ladies, Kathy Marker, and she asked her husband, Dave Marker, which was Donnie's lieutenant at the time. And he came over and did it for me. But it just,
good.
You know, it's just, it puts a very sour note, you know. Another example is when, you know, I was trying to do the In Memory Of video and had called Denver to, you know, get their okay to use their the headquarters and their memorial for the video. And I thought Denver would be very excited because it was, it's great publicity for them. You know, we use their officers, their memorial. And they just, you know, there was one gal, Sharon Segura, that, you know, was very helpful, and she's always helpful. But, you know, I mean, I would have thought some of the higher-ups might have shown up just to say, hey, Kelly, thanks for thinking of Denver. You know, this is a national video, and, you know, you pushed to have Denver be involved with this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's, I don't know. It's, I realize that you have to get on with your life. I mean, everybody does, and the police department has to get on with their life, but it's still, there are times when you really feel like you could use their help, and they're just, they're too busy, and it's just kind of a shame.
Can you, I know that you're very active in concerns for police survivors, concerns of police survivors, which is known as COPS. Can you share a little bit about how you got involved and what you do and what they do, because it sure sounds like they're filling a lot of those gaps.
Absolutely. It's a great organization. I got involved actually because of a gal in California that had reached out to me because we had very similar situations with the illegal status. Her husband had also been killed, and the gentleman had gone over to Mexico, and she was just such a big help to me. I mean, I, you know, she was a total stranger, but she could completely relate to my situation. And I found just the fact of having someone to talk to that could relate to me and that I could relate to was so beneficial in my healing process. And I had gone to their spouse's retreat, and I, you know, obviously, Donnie had died in May, and I had gone to the spouse's retreat in September, and my wounds were very, very fresh. But what going to the spouse's retreat showed me was that there was life after this, that you know, it was up to me to choose my path. And I saw a lot of widows there that after, you know, 5, 6, 9 years were still stuck in the same grieving place. And then I saw widows that were 2, 3 years out that had learned to laugh again. And, you know, it was really an eye-opener for me to realize that I have control of my own destiny. I can either make, you know, this is a make it or break it. And it's just, it's an organization that just puts together people that have similar situations, and we help each other. You know, just like having, you know, my conversation today, you know, parts of this conversation I have had with other widows here in Colorado. You know, I'm a person that they can call at 2 o'clock in the morning when they can't sleep, and I can talk to them about, you know, different issues, and they can talk to me, and I'm not going to judge them. No matter what they say, you know, I'm not going to judge how they feel. But COPS does anything from, you know, attending the funeral to, you know, helping the kids. If they can't find counseling services, we can help them do that. We have all types of retreats, from spouses to in-laws to the kids' camps are absolutely incredible. Kelsey and I went on the kids' camp last year, and it put her with kids that their parents aren't divorced. You know, they actually have, you know, their parent was on the police department and was, you know, killed or you know, died. Right. And, you know, she was able to open up to these kids the way that she can't with anybody else at school. They put them through a little bit of counseling, but they make it in a fun way. They get to share memory books about their parent. It's just, it's a great network of people to be able to connect. And then, you know, we're all about also teaching the departments, you know, the correct way to notify someone that their officer has died. You know, we've got a lot of departments, and you think it doesn't exist, but they'll make a phone call, or they'll have to hear it on the news, or they'll send, you know, the chief won't go to their house. I mean, it's, you know, it's kind of unbelievable. You don't think that that stuff's happening today, but it is.
Well, there are a lot of departments just in the United States alone, and some of them are pretty small, and if they've never even thought about it, they don't have any kind of a policy in place or any kind of a procedure on what to do, I'm sure it comes as a complete shock, and I'm thrilled that there's an organization out there that helps with that, so at least they have the opportunity to prepare themselves in advance. Whether they take advantage of that or not remains to be seen.
Exactly, and luckily enough, we just partnered with the Law Enforcement Memorial Committee with Don Kramer, and a CD was actually, in May, was actually mailed out to all law enforcement agencies within Colorado regarding procedures on line of duty death. And really it was, you know, it's a tool for them to use to develop their own procedures. But, you know, when you've got a department that, you know, is small and they don't know what to do, you know, I'm hoping that they would have popped the CD in and at least gotten someone on the department familiar with some of the things. You know, one of the other things that we can do is help the departments file that public safety officer benefit. You know, if the departments don't know how to fill it out, you know, some families go a year or two without actually receiving their benefit because nobody on the department knows how to fill it out, nor will they ask for help. So we immediately contact the department and say, okay, we've got the resources to help you fill out that paperwork. You know, let us know. And we have the ability to know whether or not it's been filled out and filed. So, you know, if we know they haven't filled it out and filed it, we can call them and say, okay, it's not done yet. I mean, our purpose is to make things better for our current surviving families as well as those that are to come. Because inevitably, there will be more. I mean, we've got a funeral tomorrow, you know.
Let me give the COPS website, at least for the United States. The National Concerns of Police Survivors website is www.nationalcops.org, nationalcops.org. And they are connected with the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund here in the United States, and their website is www.nleomf.com. That's short for National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. So I know that on the National COPS website there are forms and things that would help agencies in preparing policies. So, and then, as you said, there are individual chapters in many of the states in the United States?
There are. Not all states have them, but some states have a few different chapters. I don't know right offhand which states don't have chapters, but I know that some do not, unfortunately. But I know it is a very small portion.
Yeah.
The other thing that the national website does have, which is, you know, a valuable tool, is it breaks it down state-specific regarding benefits. Like, mm-hmm. you know, for example, you know, my daughter's getting ready to go to college, and I was able to just go into that website, click on Colorado, and it gave me forms and contact people regarding, you know, her college benefits. So it's a valuable tool.
Great. The other thing I wanted to mention, and because I heard you speak there as well, is every year COPS is one of the co-sponsors of the Traumas in Law Enforcement seminar that mm-hmm. Is held around the United States. And in that three-day course, they have a fairly lengthy discussion of line-of-duty death. They also talk at length about police suicide and stress in law enforcement and what disabled officers have to go through. And I checked today, and they don't have the dates set for next year yet, but in 2010, they are going to have seven of those seminars to be held around the United States. They're free to law enforcement officers and agencies. And next year they're going to be held during the months of January, February, and March. So people should check that nationalcops.org website, and they will post the dates for next year coming up soon.
And there is normally one close to Colorado. Last year we did have it in Colorado. It was up in, was it Westminster?
Yes.
And then the year prior it was in Wyoming. So normally there is one within the surrounding states. And all you have to do is register.
I'm sorry. It looks to me like they try to do it regionally. And I know that I attended the one here in Colorado, but we had people from, I think, 20 other states send officers. So they try to spread them around the country, and they try to have a little bit of a spectrum of time so that agencies can get people to either the closest one or the next available one. And I would highly recommend it. It was an outstanding program, and I would refer people to Cops Alive. We did a blog article about the one this last year. You can just check for traumas in law enforcement on our website. And, Kelly, you just briefly touched on the In Memory of music video that I thought I would mention, too. You can also find that on the Cops website or the Cops Alive website. But it's a wonderful music video performed specifically for survivors of law enforcement and has been used as a fundraising opportunity, and it is very touching. And you had a lot to do with that, I guess.
I did. I was very fortunate to be contacted to help on that video, and we actually used, you know, Colorado survivors. My family's in it and some of the other members that are on the Colorado board, and it turned out beautiful. And I do have some actual copies of that, so if anybody, you know, is interested in purchasing that, they can certainly get a hold of me to do that. But it did turn out very nice. My hope is that, you know, it will be shown at actual departments. You know, it's a topic that needs to be discussed. You know, you hope that it never happens, but, you know, it very well could be, and it's much better to be prepared and have your family prepared.
Yeah. we're going to go about 10 more minutes on our live broadcast, and I've received a couple of questions, but I also wanted to remind anybody listening that if you're listening to us live on the web, there is a question and answer box, and if you have a question for Kelly, if you just type that up and click the submit button, it comes right to my computer screen, and I will pass that on. But Kelly, would you be willing to answer a few questions?
Oh, absolutely.
And actually, I like this one because I was going to ask you earlier, and I didn't really want to interrupt you, but the question is, if you had to do it all over again, would you still marry a police officer? And I think the bigger question there is, you know, what's life like being married to a police officer and worrying about that knock on the door that you might get someday?
You know, if I had to do it all over again, you know, absolutely. You know, Donnie wasn't a law enforcement officer when I married him, but, you know, I knew that that's what he wanted to do. And, you know, I'm just a firm believer that, you know, as he was, that, you know, you need to do things in life that make you happy. You know, if we're all afraid of dying, we would never come out of our house. And, I mean, when people talk to me, they, you know, when he was alive, you know, I got that question a lot. Well, aren't you afraid that something's going to happen to him? And it's something that, you know, you can't really think about 24/7. My thought on it was, you know, that when it's his time to go, when it's my time to go, it's going to happen. And I would, you know, he loved doing what he did, and I would much rather if I had to lose him, I would rather have lost him knowing that he was doing something that he loved. Mm-hmm. You know, being married to a police officer, it's a struggle. They're a hard bunch to live with. You know, there's no lie. They work a lot. They work a lot of odd hours. You know, you need to be very independent and very strong, and you need to, I mean, not, I don't know, 9 times out of 10 from what I've seen, it's the wife that runs a police household because the husband has gone a lot. But I got to tell those police officers out there, you know, that work is not what defines you. You know, your family is, and being a good person is, and the overtime is good, and the overtime's out there, and it's plentiful, or at least it used to be. But don't get wrapped up into the money part of it, because, you know, your family is so important, and you need to be there for your kids. And luckily, you know, Donnie had figured that out, that, you know, being with his children and making sure he was at all those soccer games was extremely important.
Good for him. I had another question, and I was certainly thinking, how are the kids, and how has this affected them?
You know, I'm extremely lucky. I've got two really wonderful daughters. You know, Courtney is, she's graduated, you know, with honors from high school. She's going to CU Boulder here in August. And she's, you know, she's just a great kid. I mean, I've been very lucky. I've never had any problems with her. I mean, she's taken this experience and really risen above it. She's had, there's been, you know, a few kids in her school that have lost a parent through different types of events, and she's very good about reaching out to them and helping them in any way that she can. So I'm extremely proud of her. And Kelsey is, she's so much like Donnie, it's just unbelievable. She's extremely athletic, and she's good in school, and she just has his outgoing love life personality. And she's, you know, she's just, I'm really, really lucky. These types of things can break a family. And I'm just lucky that we had a good, solid family structure prior to this happening.
Well, I'm glad to hear they're doing well. One of the other questions we have, and I'll kind of compile this into one, asks about what suggestions do you have for police managers in dealing with a death notification, or what would you suggest for them in working with survivors after a funeral or after the trial?
I think probably one of the most important things about the notification is that, you know, somebody actually goes out to their house. It was extremely important to me to have the chief there, but it was also important for me to have someone I was familiar with. And I knew Jimmy. I had known him for years. And, you know, having him there was a very comforting, I think I took it better coming from Jimmy than I would have probably if just the chief would have shown up. Mm-hmm. What, as far as support goes afterwards, what I would like to see is that, you know, you are given, or at least with my case, I was given a liaison that was there to help me throughout, you know, the funeral and not really so much the trial, but kind of the getting through the funeral. But my suggestion would be is that, you know, each family be provided a liaison. And I'd like to see that be a lifetime liaison. It might not be able to be the same person, but I think there would be, could be a way that, you know, if they're provided one person and they move out of the department or can't do their job anymore, that they could be handed off to another person. You find that even as years go by, you still need help with things such as benefits, your pension check, your workman's compensation stuff. And you just kind of find that, you know, even as years go by, that you don't know who to call anymore. And, you know, I think if you had one person with each police department that could be assigned to a family, I could pick up the phone and call and say, you know, hey, Jeff, I've got a problem with this. Can you help me with it? And they'll find the answers for you. I think that just that little simple thing could, you know, make, build a better rapport between the survivors and the family members.
That's a great suggestion. We're just about out of time. I want to thank you for being our guest. I want to thank you for being strong. I want to thank you for all the work you've done for COPS, for Concerns of Police Survivors. You know, I think you're paving the way for those that come after you and trying to make things a little bit better. Even though you can't take away all the pain, you can certainly make it better. And I think you should be commended for all the work that you're doing, and certainly all the people involved in the COPS organization. I certainly take my hat off to all of them and appreciate what you're doing. I think all the police officers out there listening, you know, we say things like, you're part of our family and we'll always be there for you, and then we don't really have any understanding what that means. And maybe after today, maybe they'll know what it means, and everyone can work a little bit harder.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you for having me on and, you know, bringing awareness. You know, it's certainly there that your life does go on and you can be happy again. And, but it's, you know, it's a rough road. And, you know, if I can help any other survivor get through it, I certainly, that's what I would like to do.
Thank you, Kelly. Let me mention those websites again. I have a couple others, actually. The Concerns of Police Survivors website is nationalcops.org. There is also the NLEOMF.com, which is the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. Together they work on that Traumas in Law Enforcement conference. There is also a website for wives of police officers at wivesbehindthebadge.org and the National Police Wives Association at nationalpolicewivesassociation.org. And finally, there are police wives online that you can find at policewives.org. My name is John Marks. This is a Cops Alive audio program. Cops Alive is here to try to help police officers and other policing professionals plan for and live happy, healthy, and successful lives, both on the job and beyond. And Cops Alive is a national partner with Concerns of Police Survivors, so we absolutely support survivors and invite you to tune in again for our next teleseminar. Again, this is John Marks saying thank you very much, and our thanks to Kelly Young. We will be back in about a week or so, and I look forward to talking to you then.